was Simplicius Simplicissimus, the overture to Carl Amadeus Hartmann's opera from a brand new recording of it. It's a stunning piece. There we heard the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Marcus Stentz. And that's just about it for this edition of Sunday Morning. I'll be here during the week with Essential Classics, where my guest will be the crime writer Patricia Cornwell, and my artist of the week is the violinist Julia Fischer. So I do hope you'll be able to join me for that. But thank you for your company today. I do hope you've enjoyed the selection of music. Next Sunday, my featured singer is the much-loved Mexican tenor Rolando Villazón, and the legendary Schneider Quartet perform what is possibly the most moving of Haydn's Opus 76 quartets. That's number 5 in D major with its heavenly slow movement. And my theme is of men and mountains, with music by Schubert, Vincent Dandy, Carl Ruggles and Alan Hovhaness. All worth staying in for. So please do join me. That's the same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this week by Neil Miners.
World War One on the BBC. The epic drama Homefront returns to Radio 4.
Oh, Freddy.
My son.
Gentlemen, please, would you lower the coffin so I can see the lid?
Each episode is set exactly 100 years ago.
Goodbye and good riddance to the worst year of our lives. Goodbye, 1914. Hello, 1915. The year it all comes good again.
The new series of Homefront, each weekday at midday over on BBC Radio 4, starting tomorrow and afterwards on the Radio 4 website.
Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just after midday and time for Private Passions. And Michael Barclay's guest this week is the artist Anthony Green.
Anthony Green has a highly distinctive style, and anyone who's seen his work, and indeed there'll be many because his paintings are in the Royal Academy, the Scottish National Gallery, the Met in New York, will also have had quite an intimate glimpse of his private life. Because in painting after painting, and for more than 50 years, he's recorded family life at home with his mother, his grandchildren, or in bed, making love to his wife even. They're highly coloured, hyper-realistic paintings, and usually aerial views. And, Anthony, a very individual sense of perspective. You even chop up the canvas sometimes, don't you, and splay out the pieces to distort the perspective.
What I'm trying to do is reconcile the fact that when I have pictures in my mind, in my memory bank, they don't have rectangles around them. I have a sufficiency of imagery in my head to make pictures about my life, but none of them have got rectangles around them. I don't have a solution to it. I know the rectangle is an affectation, so shall I go looking for the perimeter of my imageries from my stories? And that's really what I've been doing. I search for a relevant perimeter so that you have a picture of perhaps boy and girl in bed. Perhaps you'll stop the story where the bed edge or the counterpane stops, or where the ceiling line or the door is. You stop it where the narrative stops, and it makes for irregular-shaped pictures. I wouldn't ask young students to necessarily make funny shaped pictures just because old Green's been doing it, because it's rather dangerous. Just imagine if you had a swimming pool where you never quite knew where the edges were when you dived in, and you could drown artistically.
Well, one thing which has prevented you, Anthony, from drowning, artistically speaking, is your wife, and you've painted her over and over again, haven't you, since you were married?
Literally hundreds and hundreds of times. She has been the catalyst. Once I took that original decision that I should paint about my love for this girl, one thing led to another. You have a honeymoon, then you have a second wedding anniversary, then you have children. Children don't survive. Some do. Some grow to adulthood. So the story, your narrative, is never stale. Goes on and on and on. Now I'm doing Being a Grandfather, painted our grandchildren. They were in this year's summer exhibition, a couple of them. The story just won't stay still. It's like a moving target. You'll stay fresh. You know, I feel fresh now, and I've been painting for about 53 years. I met Mary at the Slade. She was 17, and I was 16 and a bit. So I married an older woman. We have a good joke about that. And it's just gone on and on and on. That particular catalyst of meeting Mary Cousins Walker at the Slade has made my life as a professional artist possible. No Mary, no Green.
But I think more than that, actually, you do feel that she was very much responsible for you finding your identity as a painter.
Oh, yes, I was incredibly lucky. In 1957 at the Slade, there were 100 different ways to be an artist. You could have been an abstract expressionist, or from Jackson Pollock. You could have thrown paint around. You could have been a sort of social realist, sort of like Bratby. You could have been a hard-nosed abstractionist. But there were 100 different ways. And as a student, I, in a way, wanted to get an inkling as to what sort of artist I ought to be or could be. The only clever question I've ever asked myself was when I left the Slade. I went to Paris on a scholarship, sitting in a very small, cheap hotel where I'd kind of took lodgings. I asked myself the question, what really interests me? What am I going to spend the rest of my life painting? And how? Am I going to be a sort of sub-Salvador Dali? And the answer I got was a non-art question. The answer was, you're in love with this girl. You're going back to marry her in 6 months' time. That is at the centre of your consciousness. Paint that. So I started doing that. And I have, if I can just press the point home, that I was a 50s lad in the sense that the permissive society hadn't been invented yet. Although I'd seen rows and rows of naked ladies in the life rooms at the Slade, my future wife and I hadn't been to bed together yet. There was no question of going to bed together. We were engaged for 4 years. So our honeymoon night was our honeymoon night. Now, I sound a bit like your parish priest gone wrong saying that, but that's the way it was in the late 50s, early 60s.
Must have been a particularly fulfilling evening.
It was unforgettable.
Well, actually, the first music, I think, comes from this period, doesn't it? Because you both went to see an opera.
Yes, on our honeymoon, we went to the Paris Opera House and we went and bought tickets and tickets to see Tannhäuser. Hadn't been to the Paris Opera House ever, so it was a double first. Not been to listen to a Wagner opera. And there we were, sitting in the nice stall seats with sort of French assistants in military uniforms serving sort of small kind of chocolat glacé in the intervals, and the ceiling that had been sort of glued up by Chagall, and this amazing music, this colossal music that just kind of filled your very being. It kind of went in through your head and out through your toes.
Well, it's rather appropriate in a sense that that it should be Wagner on your honeymoon, because it's very erotically charged,
yes,
isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. And I think, in a way, music does that to you. It operates on a multiplicity of levels. More levels, I hesitate to say, than painting.
Well, here's the overture to Tannhäuser. Music from the overture to Wagner's Tannhäuser, with Daniel Barenboim conducting the Staatskapelle Berlin. Actually, Anthony Green, quite apart from your honeymoon, there's another very good reason why we should have something connected to Paris, and that's because your mother was French, wasn't she?
Yes, the French connection is big in my makeup. I'm exactly half French. I was brought up in a French immigrant environment in London, North London. I didn't speak English till I was four and a bit when I went off to a nice Catholic girls' convent because of the Blitz they let little boys in. My father politely requested that possibly the boy could start learning to speak English because, after all, he was an English schoolboy, etc. But the French thing was very important to me. Right the way through, even my student days at the Slade, I took English painting not at all seriously. I thought we were an offshore sort of fog-bound island and that the heavy-duty action took place on the continent. If you wanted to see great art, you had to go to Paris, Berlin, Florence, Rome. I was a priggish, narrow-minded kind of little European, really.
So you knew the Louvre almost better than
the
National Gallery?
Far before I ever bothered to go soaring round the National Gallery on my holidays. My mother, who was working, used to send me off to France to spend the whole of the summer holidays with her sister in central France. And I used to go to the Louvre. I went to the Louvre many, many times before I'd even been to the National Gallery.
Actually, it's interesting you say this, because I do think your work has a very distinctive voice to it.
I suppose if you attack on a very narrow front, as I have for the last kind of 60 years, it does have a certain kind of manic quality to it. Somebody might say, well, he does it quite well, but he only does a tiny little thing quite well. Well, so be it. I mean, to say a little thing well done possibly is excusable.
You could say that about somebody like Fauré or Poulenc. You know, I mean, one needs all of these various things to place into context.
We live in a difficult world because with the revolutions that have taken place in contemporary art, you're expected to be a genius every day of your life.
And an innovator.
And an innovator. And, of course, you are not. If you're an innovator for 1% of your time on Earth as a creative person, you're doing very well indeed. And as I say, I'm a 1% man when it comes to revolutions.
Well, it's surely more important, I think, is that people have their own voice, their own original voice, their distinctive thing. And I think you certainly have that. And it's true, actually, funnily enough, of the singer-songwriter who sums up a quintessential element of France, and that's Charles Trenet. I imagine that this is a song that you enjoyed very much at that time.
Yes, I discovered it in France when staying with my aunt and uncle years and years ago. And also it comes with an anecdote, because my uncle, in fact, who was an optician, but during the occupation, he worked for one of his cousin who had a big chain of optical stores in France called Les Frères Lissac. And my uncle remembers that one day somebody flounced in off the street, a very flowery chap, sort of kind of all arms and legs and sort of charm and everything else, and it was Charles Trenet. And he said he was so kind of out of this world. He was so realistically kind of effeminate and gorgeous and marvellous and charming. And he's the man that, you know, that I can endlessly listen and laugh at his songs.
La pendule fait tic-tac, tic-tic, les oiseaux du lac pic-pac, pic-pic, glou-glou-glou font tous les dindons, et la jolie cloche ding-ding-dong, mais boum, quand notre cœur fait boum, tout avec lui dit boum, et c'est l'amour qui s'éveille. Boum, il chante Loving Bloom, au rythme de ce boum qui redit boum à l'oreille.
a changé depuis hier et la rue a des yeux qui regardent aux fenêtres. Y a du lilas et y a des mains tendues sur la mer, le soleil va paraître. Boum, l'astre du jour fait boum. Tout avec lui dit boum, quand notre cœur fait boum boum. Le vent dans les bois fait ouh, la biche aux abois fait mè. La vaisselle cassée fait fric fric frac, et les pieds mouillés font flic flic flac. Mais boum, quand notre cœur fait boum, tout avec lui dit boum, l'oiseau dit boum, c'est l'orage. Brrr, boum, l'éclair qui lui fait boum, et le bon Dieu dit boum, dans son fauteuil de nuage. Car mon amour est plus vif que l'éclair, plus léger qu'un oiseau, qu'une abeille. Et s'il fait boum, s'il se met en colère, il entraîne avec lui des merveilles. Boum, le monde entier fait boum, tout avec lui dit boum, quand notre cœur fait boum boum.
I get the impression, Anthony Green, that your heart still goes boom quite a lot. You have that dancing quality to your countenance.
I'm very fortunate. I was born so that my glass is only ever half full. So even with age creeping up on us, we can still have a laugh and a giggle. And in fact, art has also got to be something that can be cheerful. Treni, of course, poet-songwriter, you know, some of these songs were written during the German occupation of Paris and France, when in fact they were grey, dark, miserable days, and these were songs which could kind of get you through to tomorrow morning.
Do you listen to music when you're actually painting?
I have sessions when I listen to music. Sometimes I paint in complete silence, and then suddenly I'll have a sort of a passion and I'll put on sort of French chansonnier, or I'll put on sort of comedy records, or then I'll put on something kind of classical and serious and listen to sort of Italian opera and...
Or the radio?
I have moments when I listen to the radio. One of my problems is that I'm sort of a technophobe, so in fact it's very difficult to actually tune the radio in nowadays.
Well, you did manage to put on the first classical record you ever bought, I think, which was what we're going to hear next.
Yes, Beethoven. Mm. And I suppose as a youngster, by then I was going to one class a week, music appreciation, when I was in school. And so we were made to listen to things like Beethoven and Bach and Schubert and Mozart. And little by little, it began to kind of seep into me. And the Beethoven was a must, in a sense. It's sort of like almost like self-education, really. I knew that it was very important. I wasn't certain quite why. But, of course, I now realise that building a symphony or a concerto is like composing a picture. And I make the analogy repeatedly when talking to younger artists that, in fact, that painting a picture or making a sculpture, it's like a chef d'orchestre or a composer. You have little piccolos and kettle drums and clarinets and the violins and the violas all come in. They have different sizes and speeds and textures, and you put it all together. It's called composition. Nowadays, it's a very unpopular word in the fine art painting school. You sound rather old-fashioned when you talk about composition, but I hold to it. I can't paint a picture unless I actually apply what I know about composition, or whether I'm going to stretch the rules or bend them or make them outrageous or go back to sort of first principles and use a bit of that. And I suspect that my colleagues who write music do the same thing.
Thank you.
Rudolf Serkin was the soloist in the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5, the Emperor Concerto. We heard the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein, in a performance from 1962, so probably just after you were getting your LPs, Anthony Green. And by the way, all the details of today's recordings are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, along, indeed, with images from Anthony Green's paintings. We've talked about how you were brought up in a very French household, Anthony, but actually your next choice is someone that I imagine you consider a quintessential English gentleman.
Yes, one of my first sort of moments of awareness in my bedroom now, flat in North London, was that there was a wind-up gramophone with a box, with a filing system under it with little doors. It was a very grand kind of wind-up sort of HMV thing. And I remember discovering in the cupboard large 78 records, and on tiptoe, I could just reach the handle and lift the lid and put them on. And one of the first records I ever remember being aware of playing a record was something quite delightful. And it turned out to be, when I read the label, it said Cavalcade Noel Coward. And the thing that got me was the man's voice, his enunciation. It was so singular. And I was transfixed by it, and I never forgot it. So that in later years, every time something by Noel Coward came up, I was all ears.
And the interesting thing is, it's a little bit like Fred Astaire. There isn't, in fact, a real voice there, but it's the artistry that he brings to it.
Yes, I mean, he's a terrific performer. And he could perform on so many levels, from the heroic sea captain all the way down to a kind of a mob boss in prison with Michael Caine. I mean, he could do all sorts of things. And, you know, if you could have dropped me into his home in the West Indies to sort of be at a dinner party, I would have loved it. I would have been completely out of my depth because he was so articulate and funny and witty.
Blues, 20th century blues, they're getting me down. Who's escaped those weary 20th century blues? Why, if there's a God in the sky, why shouldn't he grin high above this dreary 20th century din? In this strange illusion, chaos and confusion, people seem to lose their way. What is there to strive for, love or keep alive for? Say, hey, hey, call it a day. Blues, nothing to win or to lose. It's getting me down. Who's escaped those weary 20th century blues? Why is it that civilized humanity can make this world so wrong? In this hurly-burly of insanity, our dreams cannot last long. We've reached a deadline, the press headline, every sorrow. Blues value is news value tomorrow. Blues, 20th century blues, they're getting me down. Who's escaped those weary 20th century blues? Why, God in the sky, why shouldn't he grin high above this dreary 20th century din? In this strange illusion, chaos and confusion, people seem to lose their way. What is there to strive for, love or keep alive for? Say, hey, hey, call it a day. Blues, nothing to win or to lose. it's getting me down. Who's escaped those weary 20th century blues?
Noel Coward singing those 20th century blues, bewailing the chaos and confusion of the age he lives in, which brings us to very comfortably to this next question, Anthony. As a painter, do you not bother about the ups and downs of fashion?
Oh, I'm very aware. I've always been a very competitive sort of professional artist. That's what I am. I'm a professional artist. I paint pictures to earn. I earn my living at it. Sometimes you turn the heat, central heating off. Sometimes you put the champagne corks. It's that sort of life. It's been terrific, very exciting. Yes, of course, I'm aware of what's going on around me, and some of it you applaud and think is absolutely wonderful, and other things simply, you know, you don't think much of them and you just keep going. But you can't spend your life bemoaning the fact that possibly that you were sort of being listened to and reviewed 10 years ago, and possibly nowadays not quite as often. The English love promising youngsters. The number of exhibitions I remember when I was a youngster called Artists of Fame and Promise, which kind of got, you know, heavily reviewed in The Guardian and The Times and things like that. We're all in it for the long haul. History is perched on my shoulder like a rather knowledgeable parrot. And you see that some of the artists that you admire, they're all dead when they were 37. 37 is a kind of danger year. You know, when I got past 37, I breathed a sigh of relief. On the other hand, perhaps I should have stopped at 37, because a lot of my heroes were either dead or committed suicide at 37. And then you see other artists who one admires terrifically, who went on and on and on, who never had exhibitions, who lived to be sort of 70, 80. And, you know, they didn't have the sort of fame and they didn't have the promise, let alone the fame, that we all expect as our sort of due nowadays. So you just keep going, you know. It's a lonely business being a painter, even with a wife who's kind of very attentive and also an artist, and we do talk about art an awful lot, is that you spend most of the time locked away in your room, studio, getting
doing
on with
your
the job.
Thing.
Yes.
You were painting figurative narrative paintings when everyone else tended to be moving into abstraction.
Yes, this was something I was very aware of. When I made the decision to be a narrative, again, the word narrative is a no-no, figurative, a no-no. All the best democratic artists were actually non-figurative, sort of once the Berlin Wall was up and running, and, you know, the West was a place of non-figuration and liberation. So if you were figurative, there was a kind of, you were tainted a little bit with kind of what went on behind the, behind the Berlin Wall.
Well, that was the same in music for a while. If you were tonal, you were looked down upon. Do you get frustrated by some of the young British people who get lauded to the skies?
I don't think so. The thing is that I'm now in my middle 70s, and they're still only in their 60s. So they've still got a difficult passage to progress. So in a sense, we have this kind of similar kind of journey to Damascus to partake in. You know, sometimes you're the flavour of the week, sometimes you're the flavour of the month, and sometimes you're ignored. It's fashion. How can I best put this without sort of sounding... When you've been on the game, so to speak, for decades and decades and decades, you just keep going, you know. And at the moment, I'm working on a series of self-portraits, three-dimensional self-portraits, i.e. you cut a hole in the front canvas and the hole in the back reveals another painting and yet another painting. So I've been going back in time 50 years through cutting holes in little pictures. They're like sandwiches that you hang on the wall. Nobody's seen them yet.
Well, Bach next, and something I think you listen to in your studio while you're painting.
Well, having sort of discovered Beethoven, Bach kind of came along later, and it was spare, more arid for a youngster. There were less notes, and yet they made a much bigger impression. And if you heard Bach on the organ, as I did all those years ago, it took you to paradise. It lifted you out of your chair. If you could have actually levitated when you sat in a church or in a concert hall when a Bach piece was played on an organ, it was an out-of-this-world experience. I can't really put it better than that. I frequently paint pictures where as a state of mind, I have my wife and I floating lovingly out of bedroom windows. Now, neither of us know how to fly, but art allows you to take off. Bach does that.
Thank you.
The Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Bach, Wayne Marshall, playing the Harrison and Harrison organ in Coventry Cathedral. Another way you could be seen as unfashionable, Anthony Green, is that you paint religious subjects now.
Oh, it's the kiss of death. It's rather like painting dogs and children. It's the kind of, you shouldn't do it. Not if you want to have a plenty of street cred. The trouble is, you are who you are. My mother was a Catholic. My father couldn't have cared less what he was. So he was called nominally Church of England. Just to irritate my mother, he occasionally said he wasn't sure whether he was Plymouth Brethren or not. But that was just him kind of being humorous. And I had religious pictures pinned over my bed when I was a child. And eventually I discovered that there were kind of alternatives. When I fell in love with Mary, I discovered that she belonged to a kind of a strange Christian sect called the Congregationalists. And then I discovered a bit of research, of course, that Oliver Cromwell was a Congregationalist. And then I discovered that they, in fact, went in for things like kind of democracy before British democracy had really been fully established. And this seemed like a rather nice thing. So I switched horses midstream and became a nonconformist. And we brought up our children going to church, chapel. I became an elder for a time. And I found, in fact, that my métier as a Christian was to paint pictures which could probably or hopefully propel a few people through the gates of paradise.
How do you imagine paradise?
Paradise is an abstraction. I couldn't possibly comment. It's beyond my ken. It's beyond my knowledge. I don't know. But my optimism, my faith, call it what you will, tells me that it'll be all right after the journey. It'll be uplifting and optimistic. And I'm so well trained, I don't want to use words like God and the light of God. You've got to be so careful. How do you actually paint God? Well, on my resurrection sculpture, I had a 1,000-watt light bulb, which had actually illuminated a Esso garage on Stanmore Hill many years ago. So you see the difficulties I've got. You know, I'm actually dealing with things of which I know nothing. But I have a hunch that it's going to be all right. I'm damned if I'm going to actually go through this life thinking that when I drop dead, I'll just end up in a garden centre.
Well, your
picture... not an option. It's not an option.
Well, paradise on earth for you is a cottage with hollyhocks, isn't it?
Yes, of course. You have to live with your decisions. We bought a cottage with hollyhocks up the front in 1971 in Cambridgeshire, and I don't suppose anybody will ever forgive us for it. And the hollyhocks are still there, and the cottage is still there, and there are more flowers, and there's more garden, and all that. It's very difficult to kind of keep it all under control, but it's our little bit of heaven.
Well, from the sublime, talking of paradise, to the ridiculous. If we said that we're about to hear Eric Idle, we would imagine Monty Python or something like that. But it's actually, he was in Jonathan Miller's Mikado, wasn't he?
Yes, yes, and which we saw at the National Opera. Hmm. And loved every minute of it. It was simply marvellous. And when he reads his little list out, it had us in stitches. And I have to confess now that if we want to cheer ourselves up, if it's drafty, we live in a cottage which is not kind of draft-proof and it's cold and a bit miserable and a glass of sort of claret hasn't kind of quite done the job, we put Eric Idle on and it cheers us up.
Someday it may happen that a victim must be found. I've got a little list of society offenders who might well be underground and who never would be missed. They never would be missed. There's interior designers, window dressers and that sort. Bank robbers who retire to Spain the minute they get caught. All those who have their noses pierced, all men who dye their hair. All idiots who host chat shows and disc jockeys everywhere. And customs men who fumbling through your underwear insist they none of them be missed, they none of them be missed.
He's got them on the list, he's got them on the list. And they none of them be missed, they none of them be missed.
There's the people with pretentious names like Justin, Trish and Rolf and the gynecologist. I've got him on the list. All muggers, joggers, buggers, floggers, people who play golf, they never would be missed. They never would be missed. All waitresses who make you wait, accountants of all kinds, and actresses who kiss and tell and wiggle their behinds, and poncy little singers who to entertain us try by dressing up like women and by singing far too high, and who on close observance must be either stoned or pissed. I don't think they'd be missed. I'm sure they'd not be missed.
He's got them on the list. He's got them on the list. And then none of them be missed. They're none of them be missed.
There's the beggars who write letters from the Inland Revenue, and the gossip columnist. I've got him on the list. Comedians and weightlifters and opera singers too. They'd none of them be missed. They'd none of them be missed. All traffic wardens, bankers, men who sell Venetian blinds, all people who wear silly ties, Australians of all kinds, and nasty little editors whose papers are the pits, who fill their rags with gossip and with huge and floppy writs. But anyway, I think by now you must have got the gist. They'd none of them be missed. They'd none of them be missed.
You may put them on the list. You may put them on the list. And then none of them be missed. They're none of them be missed.
Very funny. Very witty. What a marvellous team. The words, the music, and Eric Idle. If I can reproduce some of that in some of my paintings, I'd indeed be a very happy artist, because there's room in the human condition for jokes and fun.
I wonder who'd be on your list, Anthony Green.
Oh, angst-ridden artists who only do art for art's sake, who talk art-speak the whole time. It just puts my teeth on edge.
Anthony Green, thank you very much.
I've loved every minute of it. It's marvellous hearing the music. I shall be going back to my studio. Instead of being silent, I shall now be having Beethoven crashing out and then Eric Idle for the coffee breaks.
Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the artist Anthony Green, and you can download that programme if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest is the novelist Joel Peyton Walsh. Private Passions is produced by Elizabeth Burke. It's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. Well, a very good afternoon to you. This is Ian Skelly here to guide you through our afternoon here on Radio 3. In just a moment, a masterpiece of the chamber music repertoire in our lunchtime concert. And then at 2 o'clock, find out what a bray harp sounded like, the viol and the viola organista. All instruments forgotten today, but they were once popular. The Early Music Show gives you the chance to hear them again at 2. But first, a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime. It's read by John Shea.
The Chancellor, George Osborne, has confirmed the government's to increase spending on NHS services by £2 billion next year and in every year of the next Parliament. The Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, has challenged the Chancellor for further details on where the money will be found. Mr Osborne's also said fines paid by banks for rate rigging will be used to improve GP services. More than 100 council leaders across England have written a joint letter to a Sunday newspaper demanding more powers to run their own affairs. Published in The Observer, the letter warns that voters in England will not accept greater devolution to Scotland unless there's a similar redistribution of power south of the border. Polling has ended in Switzerland, where voters have been deciding whether to back a move for big cuts in immigration. First projections indicate that the proposal has been defeated by a large majority. The head of police in the Afghan capital Kabul has resigned following a surge in attacks in the city in recent weeks. Last night, three South Africans were killed in an attack on a guesthouse for aid workers. The victims were the head of an educational charity and his son and daughter. Pope Francis, who's visiting Turkey, has issued a joint pledge with the head of the Orthodox Church there for Christians and Muslims to work together to stop killings in the Middle East. The declaration warns that Christians are being persecuted and driven out of the region. A woman suffered serious head injuries in a collision with a police car in Bristol, which was responding to an emergency call. The Independent Police Complaints Commission has been informed. The former Conservative Health Secretary, Lord Fowler, has called for the Church of England to appoint gay bishops and give gay clergy the right to marry. Speaking ahead of tomorrow's World AIDS Day, he said there was still a great deal of prejudice and stigma around HIV and homosexuality, and the Anglican Church wasn't doing enough to combat it. and the weather. It'll be mostly dry with sunny spells, but it's likely to turn cloudy and damp across eastern and central England later. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 3 minutes past one.
John, thank you very much indeed. We'll be live at the Chapel of St John's College, Cambridge this afternoon for a service for Advent with Carols. That begins at 3 o'clock here on Radio 3. But first, our lunchtime concert, which is a second chance to hear the one we broadcast live last Monday lunchtime here on Radio 3 from Wigmore Hall in London. It was given by the Benevitz Quartet, named after a famous 19th century Czech violinist. The concert ended up being a bit too long for the time we have available this lunchtime to repeat it all, so we aren't able, I'm afraid, to hear them playing the music of Erwin Schulhoff. But if you'd like to hear those five pieces by him, then if you go to the Radio 3 website, you can hear the entire recital on the iPlayer radio. What we do have time for is their rendition of the music of Schubert, Schubert's G major quartet, his final masterpiece, really, of chamber music. In this piece, he stretched the quartet so far that it's almost as if he had nowhere else to go with it. Which is why perhaps his very last piece of string chamber music was the great C major quintet, in which he added a second cello. This G major quartet is in four movements. The third movement is a fantastically dramatic scherzo. The opening is almost symphonic, and the entire work is about the length of a symphony, 240 minutes. So here to play it, the four members of the Benevitz Quartet.